Most news reports about climate change warn about the frightening impact on humans. But what will happen to the animals and the plants? How does nature respond to sudden climate shifts? Our guest is Dr. Anthony Barnosky from the University of California, Berkeley. He is a paleoecologist, a longtime field researcher, and a curator of a museum of fossil mammal collections. His new book is Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming, and it's stirring up a lot of discussion. Dr. Barnosky, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, one of my first impressions reading Heatstroke is the immense amount of detailed work before scientists make statements about climate change. These tens of thousands of specimens and the two generations of specialists even before you. How can fossils in a museum translate into useful knowledge about the future of animals as global warming proceeds?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about climate change is this is not the first time it's happened. There have been times in the past. This time is different than any other time. So what we can do is actually use the fossils that people have collected over years and years, and sometimes in projects specifically designed to look at the effects of climate change. We can use those fossils to see what are natural responses to, quote, natural kinds of climate changes, and then compare what's going on today with that to see if we really are outside the range of normal.
Could you describe two previous warming episodes as you did in your book and how nature responded then?
Yeah, so, you know, the warming episodes that are most analogous to what's going on today are the shifts from glacial cycles into interglacials. Presently, we're in an interglacial time in Earth's history. There have been about 39 of these glacial-interglacial shifts over the past couple of million years, and they happen pretty fast. It takes about 5,000 years to go from a time when most of the northern hemisphere is covered with ice to a time like we're in today, or at least like we were in a couple of hundred years ago. And the temperature change is pretty close to what we're talking about with global warming, that is about 5 degrees Celsius. The difference is those past changes, as I said, have been over about 5,000 years, and they started in a cold time and took us into a warm time. Today, we're doing that 5 degrees projected over just 100 years or so, and we're starting in a warm time and going to a time that's even warmer, and matter of fact, so much warmer that by the 2050s, Earth is going to be a hotter place than it has ever been since humans evolved. And if we carry through with the projections of kind of the more dire case scenarios, by the year 2100, it's going to be hotter than it's been in 3 million years. And there's probably not a familiar species today that's been around for 3 million years. So very different world.
Well, I mean, are there signs that the animals and plants are already on the move in some way due to climate change?
Well, there are. There are lots of signs. People have done numerous studies now showing that many, many, many species, just about any kind of species you care to name, plant, bird, mammal, amphibian, whatever, are in many cases, the ranges are shifting to higher elevations or higher latitudes. In other cases, the populations are just dwindling and disappearing. So yes, in fact, there have been a lot of observations of responses already, and we're only, 50 years into this thing.
Well, assuming that some of the species will move north on their own, but, there's always the possibility that somebody who loves a particular plant or a particular animal will just stick a few of them in their car and drive them somewhere else. Can you talk about the discussions that are going on now about rewilding or other approaches that we could do it in a more organized way?
Yeah, so let me back up just a little before I answer that question and talk a little bit about what we have to take into account before we take that step. Now here's the problem. Most of the species, or many of the species, that we have worked very hard to preserve are inside nature reserves. And those, you can think of them as having kind of a hard fence around them, in that outside those reserves, usually there's not habitat for the species we're trying to preserve to exist in. Now, as you change climate, the climate that actually supports those species in the reserves, in many cases, is going to disappear. If we still had continuous habitat, that might be less of a problem, in that species tend to move around as climate changes to stay within their climatic boundaries. But now they can't do that. So what people have been talking about, and actually have done in some cases, for example, butterflies, is to take individuals from a species that looks like it's on the way out, move them to another place where there's still a suitable climate. So that's the basic idea. It's called assisted migration. And as I say, people have already done that with butterflies, particularly in England is the big example. There's another sort of plan, or not really a plan, but idea that people have talked about, a lot of ecologists are talking about now. That's something called Pleistocene rewilding. That's actually quite different, in that it turns out that the natural state for communities of mammals is to have a lot of great big critters in them, things elephant size and so on. And, you know, if we go back 10,000 years, from 10,000 years on back to millions of years, that was the natural state of ecosystems. About 10,000 years ago, there's a major extinction event precipitated by a combination of human impacts and a climate change, which got rid of all those big guys. So, but it turns out they are still naturally structured in Africa and places like that, primarily in Africa. So the idea about Pleistocene rewilding is, let's do what we need to do to come back to that, quote, natural ecosystem state of having these big animals interacting with the rest of the ecosystem. And the proposal is to do things like set aside tracts of land in the United States where you would bring in elephants and establish elephant herds, you know, the big carnivores that would go along with that, and so on. So that is a very dramatic thing that I think would be quite a hard sell. There's a lot of philosophical objections to that, but that's the idea behind it.
And what about habitat corridors? I'm thinking, you know, of a possible mass migration of species, but we're sort of blocking the way, as you say in your book, by giant cities like Los Angeles and all over.
That's correct, and that's a very big part of the problem. As I said, in the natural state of things, species would be moving around to try to track these climate changes. Now, there are some species that probably just couldn't move fast enough on their own anyway, given the rate at which we're changing climate. For even species that could, we have chopped up the habitat so much that they can't. So that's a very big problem with today's world as far as trying to preserve nature, is these natural corridors aren't there anymore. And one way to fix that, of course, is to look at areas where there may be enough natural habitat to connect up what we have as more or less protected lands now, or at least lands that haven't been impacted too much by people. So people have been looking at that. Conservation biologists have been thinking about these corridor ideas for quite a long time. Now the new twist is we have to predict where those corridors are, where those climate corridors are going to be as climate changes.
We're talking with Dr. Tony Barnoski, author of Heatstroke. I found it interesting that your book isn't a polemic, in that it doesn't make it all about climate. You don't discount the other threats to the world of plants and animals, like habitat destruction and over-harvesting and all the pollution. But you do say, it seems to me, that the species that are already weakened by our huge impacts may be pushed into extinction by this final challenge, the heatstroke of global warming. Is that part of your main message?
Yeah, that's very much part of the main message. You know, that today we've got these four main threats, global warming being one of them, habitat fragmentation, just growing human populations, and moving species all over the earth, invasive species that tend to, in the long run, decrease world biodiversity. So yeah, we're in a very difficult time, and the reason that global warming itself is such a danger to nature is precisely because what we were talking about earlier, this the fact that a lot of the biodiversity we're trying to preserve is in these enclosed landscapes, and if we lose them there, we lose them everywhere. So, you know, what do you do when the climatic rug is being pulled out from under a species in the only place it's left? It's a whole new challenge.
You know, I've just watched a well-known Australian geologist on TV saying, well, the climate's always changing here on Earth. Humans have survived it, animals too, so why worry? What's the big deal this time, he says?
Well, I think that's got a very simple answer, and that is, yes, climate has always changed, and it changes on many different scales, but never in the history of humans has it changed as fast or as much in terms of going from an already warm time in Earth's history to an even warmer state than it is now. So, you know, I think that's a very simple answer. Today it's too much, too fast. It's above the bounds of normal.
Well, I suppose that partly leads into my next question for you, and that is, you talk about how evolution may not be able to keep up with the changes that are coming so quickly. What is happening with evolution as far as climate change goes?
Well, so, you know, evolution is controlled by ultimately changes at the genetic level, and those changes at the genetic level are ultimately controlled by mutation rates, you know, how the sequence of molecules and genes actually gets disrupted by various factors. And it turns out those mutation rates are typically pretty slow when you compare them against the pace of the kind of climatic change we're seeing now. So yes, climatic change can put a selection pressure on a species to change and adapt, but really there's a speed limit that evolution can operate, or that evolution runs up against, and climate change is exceeding that speed limit. So it turns out that really the kinds of species that have a chance of adapting and that will probably do quite well are the kinds of species that have really short generation times and produce many, 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 many individuals with each reproduction event. So what kind of species are those? Well, they're flies, mosquitoes, rats, the kinds of things we typically don't care for as humans, and the kinds of things we do like, you know, the lions and tigers and bears have very long generation times, very small numbers of offspring, so they don't have a chance to catch up evolutionarily.
Well, we've got best and worst case scenarios coming from the IPCC and even from later reports. How does that project as far as species extinction goes? What are scientists predicting the range there might be from climate change?
Well, you know, I think the basic answer to that is we're committed to some significant amount of climate change, even under the best case scenarios. As I mentioned before, by the 2050s, right in that ballpark, Earth is going to be hotter than it's been since humans evolved as a species, and that doesn't matter which of the scenarios you use. So I think there are going to be some effects on species as far as certainly where species can live on Earth, and I think it will accelerate the rate of extinction of some of these endangered species that we're trying to protect. So that we have to take that into account and maybe change our strategies a bit on how we're trying to protect them.
I found your book quite readable and personable. You made me want to perhaps adopt a marmot. tell our listeners what a marmot is and why we might care about what's happening to them.
Well, you know, marmots are basically big squirrels, or woodchucks is a name for a very closely related animal to a marmot. The marmots I was talking about live in the high Rocky Mountains, and they're characteristic of those kinds of habitats. And they spend most of their life underground in burrows. They're out only during the summer, and only if it gets too hot, they'll go back underground too. So, you know, the reason I talk about marmots in the book is because here's an animal that really kind of protects itself from climate changes, right? Yet it turns out in the Colorado Rockies, there's sort of a subtle interaction between temperature, which brings marmots out of their burrow at a certain time of year, and snowfall. The marmots have to come out of their burrow at the time that the snowfall has reduced, or the snow cover has reduced enough so that there's enough vegetation for them to eat. They're very hungry after hibernating all winter. And if that gets out of sync, they starve to death. Okay, so what's happening now is that marmots are emerging earlier and earlier. Snow, because of warmer temperatures, there's more snow on the ground because precipitation is greater in the winter. So even though there's warmer temperatures in the spring, it's not melting the snow fast enough. So there's this very tightly synchronized life cycle that has really gotten out of whack and is affecting even these animals that have worked out ways to protect themselves from climate change.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add, a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, I think the main message is that these are definitely disturbing sorts of revelations when we think about saving nature in all the ways we think of nature, and that's not only what species are there, but what we get out of ecosystems in the way of, you know, direct benefits to humanity, things like clean water, certain plants, and so on. But also a feeling that humans really like of being connected with wilderness in various ways. All of those aspects of nature are under threat by global warming, and that's a dire prediction, but there are things we can do about it, which I talk about in the book, and I guess the point I'm trying to make is now is the time we have to start making those changes in our thought process. You know, we have to accept that these changes are on the way and now start dealing with them. One of the ways to deal with it is to do everything we can to reduce the amount of warming. But we also have to accept that there is going to be a certain amount of warming, and that means we have to manage nature in a little different way than we have.
We've been speaking with Dr. Anthony Barnosky, an active field researcher and a curator of fossil mammals at the University of California, Berkeley. His newest book is Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming, from Island Press. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.